listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hello and welcome to Babe Waves. You're listening to CITR 101.9, and this is the show of the Gender Empowerment Collective. This week we are talking about gender and literature, and we've got a lot coming up for the show. Lots of discussion, but first we're going to have an interview with Elizabeth and Alexandra Bischoff about the Rereading Room project, which you'll hear more about after this song, which we thematically planned. Here is Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush.
Could you leave me when I needed to possess you?
All right, and we are back with Babe Waves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. That was some Kate Bush for you there with Wuthering Heights from The Kick Inside, a classic tune that we thought would be appropriate for our gender and literature discussion today. And to start us off with gender and literature, I am here with Alexandra Bischoff. I had the pleasure of meeting Alexandra on Halloween, on a very spooky day, with Britt Bachman when I was subbing in on the boards for the borough. And I got to hear Alexandra talk a lot about her work. She is a local feminist artist, activist, and researcher, currently working with the Belkin Gallery and 221A. So welcome, Alexandra.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much. So we are here today to talk specifically about the Rereading Room project at the 221A Gallery in Chinatown. So I'm going to kind of let you lay the groundwork here. But before we get into the Rereading Room itself, can you tell us a bit about the Woman's Bookstore?
Yes. And I love talking about the Woman's Bookstore. So that's a wonderful place to start. The Vancouver Women's Bookstore was the first women's bookstore in Canada. It opened up in 1973. It ran until 1996. And it was an important institution in the city, not only for the work that it provided, or the place that it provided for women in literature, but also as a community space, because so many activist groups were formed there, so many women of various schools of feminism could meet there to talk. Spoken with some of the original members of the bookstore, and they said that if you were new to Vancouver, for example, your first day in the city, you could just drop by the bookstore. You could meet someone to crash on their couch that night, or find a job there, or, you know, it was a really important space. And the women who ran it, it was a not-for-profit, all volunteer-based. They put a lot of labor into it, just like we, I think, tend to overlook the labor of the so-called second wave. I'd like to take a moment and acknowledge how much work actually went into putting this this bookstore together. By reading a poem written, it's very apropos, reading a poem on the back that appeared on the back of the store's inaugural catalog in 1973. So just a little bit of context. Janine Mitchell, who wrote the catalog, there's over 400 titles in the catalog, and she felt like if they were going to open a bookstore, one person who worked there had to at least have read every single book. So she spent the months leading up to the opening of the store reading everything in the catalog, and she wrote this poem. "Doing this catalog was awful, though I got more reading done in the last 2 years than in the last 2 years. Reading in bed, on toilet, at table, on bus, worked insane stretches of time, surviving on cookies and yogurt and green pea egg swirl soup with cockroaches in it. Didn't sleep except occasionally on people's floors, curled up in the bags under my eyes. My name is Janine Mitchell, and I wouldn't dream of forgetting to scrounge whatever credit I can off this damn thing. I promise to never do it again."
That's fantastic.
I felt like as soon as all the books came in into the Rereading Room exhibition, I would do the same thing as Janine, and I would read all of the books. And I have not been able to do that yet. But
not yet.
Here's hoping.
Yeah, still a plan. The Rereading Room itself, how did that grow out of the Woman's Bookstore, the legacy of the Woman's Bookstore?
I was very fortunate to be a part of a research group at 221A in this past summer. And we were each doing our own individual bits of research, and mine focused on this catalog, which I found in the archives at SFU. At the time, I was, and I still am, doing some work for the Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery surrounding Vancouver's feminist histories and art and activism beginning in the 70s. So I found this catalog, and I shared the catalog and the poem on the back that I just read. I shared that with Vincent Tao, who's the librarian there, and he also fell in love with the idea of the store. So we together went through the catalog. We chose just about a quarter of the store's texts that they had available in that first year, and we brought them in to make available for the public to reread.
There you go. How did you pick?
That was really hard. There's four different categories in the catalog: journals and periodicals, nonfiction, fiction, and non-sexist children's literature. So we tried to pick an even number from each different distinct section.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those are some interesting categories. Be very interested to look at non-sexist children's literature. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fantastic. I wanted to ask, why do you think, so you came across this catalog, you picked out the books, you let people reread them. Why do you think Rereading Room needed to be done now?
I feel like it ended up being a lot more timely of an installation than was intended, especially with certain regressive politics that are becoming far more public. So actually, maybe to talk about this, I'm going to read just a section from Sue Negrin's book Begin at Start, which was also a part of the bookstore. Begin at start means begin with our own unfreedom, because unfreedom is our universal similarity. Class, race, sex, age, spiritual, psychological, and other forms of oppression are all aspects of a whole network of unfreedom. We're each caught in this network in a lot of different ways. The whole network has to go because freedom is our universal need. Well, I thought that was a good section to read because you know, we're still dealing with our own unfreedoms. It's amazing to me that after all of the labor of all of the previous generations of feminists, and we're still fighting, for some of the freedoms that they were fighting for in the 70s. So I felt like it was time to take another look at, I think, an often overlooked or written off generation of feminism, and remember that intergenerational connection can further bolster our activist politics.
Absolutely. And for those of us and for those listeners out there who know that we just underwent our gender empowerment collective sort of rebrand recently, I mean, those are the kind of conversations we were having when we were going through that process. And I really appreciate, bringing up the point about second wave feminism being sort of discounted as necessarily not intersectional, for mm-hmm. example, whereas you see, like, in that work, like, those were conversations that were happening. I mean, I understand, like, I think the criticisms are fair, but yeah, it's not as easy to just discount the whole,
absolutely,
wave.
Absolutely. I mean, the question of intersectionality is, as being at the forefront of contemporary feminist rhetoric, is so integral, but I think it is fascinating that, you know, even my own preconception of that era, looking through the catalog and seeing just how intersectional the catalog was in 1973 it surprised me. And it made me realize that maybe we owe those women a little more credit.
So sort of taking it contemporaneously, you guys had quite a wide range of programming going on for the Rereading Room month. Can you tell me a bit about the design of that programming, like how that came about?
Yes. So in the spirit of the original institution, which of course, as I mentioned, was much more than just a catalog of books, we wanted to bring different communities into the space, really activate the space and make that installation more of a community-based project. So we had a number of different events. The first event, we brought Janine Mitchell, who was one of the founding members of the bookstore, and she gave us a bit of a historical overview of the bookstore. The second event, we had Cornelia Weingarten and Andrea Fotana's Hogan's Alley screening, which was a film from 1993 and talks about that historical neighborhood in Vancouver that, of course, was lost to development. It was the first and only predominantly Black neighborhood in Vancouver. We had a couple of different reading events. Unfastened Collective came in and hosted some consciousness-raising circles. And we also had Vancouver's PACE Society come in and give a workshop called Sex Work 101, which was an introductory workshop into sex worker politics. And it was diverse, and each evening we had a different community group, and it was just really exciting to see how many different people we could invite in and activate the space.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I feel like, I know we were talking about this a bit before, about what community activism, and particularly like feminist activism, looks like in the city right now. I was just wondering about your take on like feminist organization in Vancouver, especially having just dug into this like past of it as you did. Like, what are your thoughts on it contemporary wise?
I think that there's a lot of amazing feminist activism that is happening today. I mean, just to rattle off a list of some amazing initiatives, Emma Talks, there's Unfastened Collective, the Art and Feminism Wikipedia Editathon, the West End Sex Worker Memorial that just was put up, the Pleasure and Protest Free School series, the Downtown East Side Women's Art Collective, Intercessions Girls Who Code, the Gender Empowerment Collective, and others that come, you know, there's lots of amazing groups that come out of universities and different art communities. And I think that what I've learned through this project, Rereading Room, and also through my work with the Belkin, is that in the 70s, activism was, it was a lot more physical. And I know that there's lots of, you know, protests that happen in the city today, but there was a time when every student at SFU was protesting something on like a weekly basis, you know? And I feel like at this particular junction in history, we might begin to see a return to the streets, taking back the streets, strikes, protests, more physical, real world action. And there's a lot of internet activism that happens. And I know we talked a little bit about that and how internet activism it can be an important tool. But I think that we might need to see a lot more of putting our physical bodies out in the name of our politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think, again, it always comes back to Trump these days, but like, yeah, we're seeing that happen at least a bit there, which is, very important. And obviously here, I mean, other things, there's a lot of, you know, environmental organizing happening right
Kinder
now.
Kinder Morgan.
Lord.
Get ready, everybody.
Oh my God. That's not about to get, yeah. That's a whole other conversation that we should have. great. Okay, so in terms of, bring it back to the women's bookstore, though, what is next for these texts, for the legacy of this that you've just been digging into?
Well, I'm so glad that they have a home. 221A purchased them for their collection. So even after the installation Rereading Room at 221A finishes in mid-January, they will have place to live in the library of 221A, and they'll still be available for people to go and read. What's really exciting is that in 2018, we're going to be given another opportunity to install the project at the Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery. 2018.
It sounds so far off, but
it's going to be a good year. the Belkin is putting together a series of projects under the larger heading or title, beginning with the 70s. So there's going to be a number of programs, and it's going to be really great. We're all going to want to be out at UBC that year.
Awesome. Wow. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, I mean, I'm pretty glad I'm at UBC right now, to be honest, because also I get to talk to you.
Oh.
Well, thank you so much, Allie. I think we're going to take a short break. We had one more piece we wanted to share, didn't we?
If there's time.
Yeah, there definitely is.
Okay, there's just something that I thought, one other thing that I thought was really pretentious with regards to, you know, what we were seeing, the beginnings of certain rhetoric that were coming out of the bookstore, is Carolyn G. Heilbrun's Toward a Recognition of Androgyny. And so I'm just going to read this short excerpt. My opinion is easily enough expressed. I believe that our future salvation lies in a movement away from sexual polarization and the prison of gender toward a world in which individual roles and the modes of personal behavior can be freely chosen. The ideal toward which I believe we should move is best described by the term androgyny. This ancient Greek word defines a condition under which the characteristics of the sexes and the human impulses expressed by men and women are not rigidly assigned. Androgyny seeks to liberate the individual from the confines of the appropriate.
Gender empowerment.
Right gender there. Empowerment.
That's what we're talking about. That was fantastic. Thank you so much, Ali.
Thank you.
Great. If for any of you out there who are interested in checking out more about the rereading room, it is those texts are going to be on display at 221A until January. As Ali said, the Christmas break or holiday break, I should say, is a perfect time to check that out, because I hopefully have a little more time on your hands. So before we come back and have more of a discussion about gender and literature, we're just going to play you right quick a little bit of a local band called Weaves. This is Cuckoo on CITR 101.9.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Babe Waves. You're listening to our gender and literature episode on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territories. Now we're going to go into our discussion portion, where we all talk about our experience with experiences with gender and literature or some of our favorite books and stuff. So just to start the conversation off, everyone, what are some of your favorite books or authors and why? Does anyone want to begin?
So I've really been enjoying Maggie Nelson, and I have two of her books with me right now. It's The Argonauts, and my personal favorite's Bluets. It's just really nice to read her work because it's very raw and super personal as well. I actually picked it up in Pulp Fiction, and I was looking for something else. I was looking for a novel by Chris Cross, and someone who's shopping there was like, oh, you should try this instead. And it turned out that she goes to school in L.A., and Maggie Nelson actually teaches there. So she was being taught by Maggie Nelson, and she found that it was really weird because she'd read all this really personal stuff about her prof, and that was cool. And, yeah, Bluets talks a lot about the color blue, basically, and anything blue. There's a lot of really fun facts in there, and it relates to how she misses somebody and how much she loved somebody as well. So that was just really nice to read. And she talks a lot about how she came to claiming her sexuality and you know, her what it's like to be a woman. And so, yeah, that's my favorite.
The first thing that like came to my brain was this book of poetry. I like find that I don't read novels that much. I mostly read poems by Alice Olson. I'm like a huge classical like nerd. Sorry, I'm just gonna like retract. Forget that I said anything so far. So like something that is like like in like academic literature, there's like the feminist like feminist like scholars are people who usually women, but like they approach a like phenomenon. I'm in sociology, so like they approach a social phenomenon from a perspective that like accounts for minority groups. Is kind of like the easiest way to describe it, I think. And Alice Olson's book, it's called In Memoriam. It like is like so perfectly like a little snapshot of that kind of idea. She went through the Iliad and then like wrote down all of the people who died, and then wrote a little like gravestone thing for them. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a series of like hundreds of like four line little mini like in memoriam poems that like if you like think about the Iliad, like it was written in ancient Greece, it was like so misogynistic, and like it's so male oriented, and like it's like the book that she produced was like still male oriented as a like because all the people who died like that are like named are men, but like kind of like beautifully remembering them in a way that like they're kind of like because in the book it's like their glory was like in death, and she's like, and her parents was really sad, like they like left like children and wives behind, so I like that like kind of was like a feminist author like and a feminist like bent on this like classic piece of poetry.
One of my favorite writers at the moment is she's kind of one from the history books. She's called Afra Behn. She's pretty famous, but I think really underrated, especially in the kind of traditional canon. She was alive during the Restoration, so in the 17th century, and actually her life is really really interesting. No one really knows where she came from, but she always supported herself in a time when it was kind of an economic necessity for women to be married. So she was married briefly, but then we think her husband might have died. She spent 2 years in a British colony in Suriname, And then when she came back, she was a spy for Charles II, just kind of out of necessity because she didn't have any money. And then he failed to pay her and she was nearly imprisoned for debt. So she turned to writing, which was really, really unusual for women, like completely unprecedented, basically, to be a professional writer, and which would basically socially condemn you to being like on the status of a whore or a prostitute. And so I guess she turned to writing just as a necessity and almost accidentally invented the novel, which she's also really underrated for, which people often cite Robinson Crusoe as the first novel, but there's a really good argument for Oronuku by Aphra Behn being one of the first novels. And it also really interesting because it tells the story of a king in Suriname who is accidentally enslaved. But some of her other works, she kind of like, she often criticizes marriage and the position that women were put in these like forced economic marriages. And she advocated for kind of like sexual freedom outside of marriages. So kind of encouraged women to be like adulterous and kind of gain their own sexual agency. So one really good play by her that explores that is The Rover. And another really good poem that explores that is called The Disappointment, which like takes the male impotency narrative and kind of like turns it around to show it from the female perspective to kind of like give sexual agency to women. So she's pretty great kind of proto-feminist writer. And Virginia Woolf like famously said that all women should go and lay flowers at Aphra Behn's grave because she gave us the ability to like speak our voice. So yeah. So yeah.
On a more contemporary note, one of the best books that I've read in like the last, I don't know, 5 years was You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine by Alexander Kleeman. It's kind of like the 2015 version of Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, because it details the kind of mental breakdown of a young woman who is struggling to live in a world where she can't really accept her body, and she lives with this roommate who she feels like is trying to become her. So struggling with her identity, struggling with consumerism and consumerism as a cult. So it kind of gets really distorted, and it becomes really like a trippy tale of like attempts to escape her own head as well as her identity. And it really kind of rocked my world when I read it.
Does anyone else have a favorite they want to mention? Do you?
Maybe. it's really hard to pick a favorite. So I've been writing down some of the things that I've been reading lately, and I feel like maybe that will serve. Has everyone read The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Gilman? Yes. Yeah. It was one that's been on my to-do list for a really long time, and it blew my mind. It's also a short one. It's one of those ones that you can read on the bus on your way home and just like completely dissolve. I also read a Donna Haraway essay lately called Tentacular Thinking, which is one of those texts that you just have to read out loud to someone because the words are, she's such a wordsmith. And because someone mentioned Chris Krause, I had to name my favorite Chris Krause novel, which is Torpor. About a woman and her much older husband going to Romania to try to smuggle out an orphan. And that one just made me want to clean the dirt out of underneath my fingernails. So it's definitely one of my favorites.
I will jump in with one. And this is a very corny pick. Mostly because I think, it's very hard for me to pick, like, a favorite or, like, any favorites, but I recently read a book by one of my favorite authors, who is Agatha Christie, which, I mean, especially in terms of if we're talking explicit feminism, like, not so much. And there are some very problematic elements of the mysteries that she writes. But when I was young, I became obsessed with Agatha Christie and specifically Miss Marple, which I was very into. And I think looking at it now, there's a lot to be said for, like, one of the widest published authors of all time being this, like, older woman in the late 30s, early 40s. Like, that itself is quite an anomaly, and, like, that was so successful. I know it was, I think, the most published works, like, Agatha Christie novels, The Bible, and one other person. Maybe
I think it's Shakespeare?
Probably Shakespeare. I think it was Shakespeare. Right? It's, like, incredible. Like, an incredible amount of like, airtime for this woman. She wrote so many freaking mysteries and, like, really good stuff. Really good stuff for you mystery buffs out there. So, like, just throwing one out to good old Agatha.
I've got one more also. Zora Neale Hurston is one of just my favorite authors. Their Eyes Were Watching God was the best, hands down the best book that I read in high school. And just, it's a story that is so rarely told of a woman's coming of age and learning to, like, love herself.
I'm actually in the middle of that right now. I was just thinking of, like, the past few books that I've been reading. I'm in the middle of that book. And then I also read The Color Purple and, oh my God, The Cage Book.
I know why The Cage
Book. I know, yeah, I know why The Cage Book thing. Thank you. And, like, just I don't read that often. I read way less than I wish I did. But I have been trying to prioritize women of color and, like, their stories in, like, my literature. Because that's, like, I don't know, like, white feminism is gross. Like, we should.
I'm so sorry, because I feel like this actually could go on forever. But in terms of talking about texts that aren't white feminist texts, I just read for this great class I was taking Margot Jefferson's memoir, Negroland, which is very incredible, not only for her writing style, but also just, like, it's a type of memoir I've never seen before. She just takes style and, like, throws it out the window and does so many different things. It's, like, a lot of history-based retrospective and poetry and, like, conversational snapshots and then kind of straight classic memoir. And it is a very, like, interesting study of race and class and her experience. And I would really highly recommend it to everybody ever, because I think she's a genius.
I'm sorry. just in light of realizing that I think all of my choices were also white women. Lee Miracle, local, fantastic writer. Goodbye Snauk is a really good one, especially for anyone who's ever visited Granville Island and wondered what the heck is up with this tiny tourist town. Well, it was not always that way. It used to be a really important territory for many indigenous tribes, and it was beautiful. I feel like you should just read Goodbye Snauk by Lee Miracle to hear her take on that story.
All right, I'll just finish off by mentioning some of my favorites that really came to my mind. Dora, when you were mentioning the woman who wrote poems from the Iliad, sort of. I've been thinking lately about a lot of, like, my favorite works are sort of rewritings of other tales. So, like, I've been reading some stories for a class that Roisin's also in, by Angela Carter, her collection, The Bloody Chamber, which are all rewritings of fairy tales. And then Jean Rhys rewrote Jane Eyre from the perspective of the mad woman in the attic. And I also just thought of the novel Free Enterprise, a novel of Mary Ellen Pleasant by Michelle Cliff. That's also a really good, it sort of retells the history of Mary Ellen Pleasant, who was a really significant activist in the, I can't remember the word, you know, like an anti-slavery activist.
Abolitionist.
Thank you so much. Can any of you think of other like sort of trends or strategies that feminist writers use in general? Not to say that there's like a unified women's writing or anything like that.
Well, I can just think of like major themes that like really popped into my brain. Like I think marriage and sexuality are like two really big ones, and just kind of like questioning and critique, like being critical of those, like as like social institutions that like women are kind of forced to take part in. Like I find that a lot of like female identified authors like deal with these a lot, because it's like something that they deal with in their like life, you know.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking sexuality, as well as just bodies is a really interesting one that I find comes up a lot in the novels that I read. Also, I mean, this could be for many authors, but I've found that a lot of women speak very freely about their emotions and like their thoughts and their feelings, which I know is something that doesn't always happen from the male authors that I have read. It's usually not so much about emotions. So yeah,
I think the idea of transforming myths is really interesting, because we learn a lot about how there's this sort of collective consciousness thread throughout literature, and as a young person growing up reading a lot of mythology and those kinds of stories myself, and being kind of a Greek mythology nerd, it's really cool to have somebody rewrite a story in a way that represents my identity better. And because a lot of classic myths and stories tend to have pretty dismal representations of women. So I think that it's a really rich breeding ground for kind of tackling the archetypes from a feminist perspective.
Yeah, and I think it's really important for women to redefine narratives that are so embedded in our cultural consciousness, like especially with fairy tales, because they, like pretty much everyone's seen Disney films. Fairy tales are so well known, and very similar fairy tales kind of crop up all over the world in different cultures, like very similar tales. And so I think it is a real act of resistance to take them and retell those stories. I think it's really empowering, and to note issues of race, like in Wide Sargasso Sea, as Claire was saying, or to like advocate for like women's sexual agency as in Angela Carter.
I think that like I just like had a thought. Like part of what is so like empowering about these like reclaimings and like reworkings of like kind of classic tales is that like all the characters like literally are archetypes. Like this is a stereotype that like you are filling, so that like if like the stories are short and like you're telling it to a child, you like they have to be able to understand it, and like, oh, that's the evil stepmother, oh, like that's the poor beautiful girl, that's the strapping prince. So and like these are stereotypes and archetypes that were created by the like patriarchal society that like was producing content. So like what is like so like beautiful about like this reworking of these things is it's like no, like you don't understand, like these are inaccurate, like they are like so embedded in the social consciousness, but like they don't actually represent anyone.
And I think I mean, I have a lot, I feel like we could do a whole episode on fairy tales because there's a lot to be said there, and particularly, yeah, this sort of myth of the collective unconscious and the way that that is used, particularly in folk and fairy tales, and the versions of those that we're familiar with, right? Because like there was a process I mean, if we're talking about like Grimm's fairy tales, for example, that was a huge process of like taking those stories from specific people, refining them, and like putting certain moral imperatives in them, and particularly like specifically binaristic gender ideals in them, right? That's like deeply embedded in that. And I don't remember where I was going with this. So there's lots to say, but also I think so part of reclaiming those stories or like taking those stories and reworking them is not only saying like this is not accurate in terms of like how I live my life, but also it's delegitimizing those as like moral ideals and like gendered ideals and like the fact that not only is this what perfect or like good, morally good, like men and women look like, but also that like even the men and women categories are not sufficient. And it's like fighting against not only those representations, but like the imposition of like those systems and understandings, I think. Yeah.
So I just recently watched Jill Soloway's master class, and maybe you know her as the producer of Transparent or of the new upcoming TV show I Love Dick, based on Chris Krause's novel. But she was talking about the female gaze as opposed to the male gaze. And something that I'm really interested in about this retelling of these fairy tales, which I'm not aware of, you said it was the Bloody Chamber. I'm curious how they're being reinterpreted, because I think that something that Jill Soloway was talking about is that the female gaze isn't, and of course, I mean, what is the female gaze? We're only just starting to begin a definition of what the female gaze is. I love her talk, though. I recommend everyone watch it. But she's thinking that it's not just an inverse of the male gaze. It's not like you take all of the elements of the male gaze and you just flip it around and turn it inside out, but that it's an entirely different approach to telling stories. She talks about a feeling seeing, which I think kind of comes back to a lot of what we're mentioning here with regards to emotion or learning about the characters in a completely different method than what we're used to in patriarchal culture production. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the Bloody Chamber and about the tactics that they take to actually reinterpret.
Well, I guess there's a few tactics that tend to recur in the stories. Oftentimes she'll use the first person and take the perspective of like the female protagonist, and then she'll often like change the endings to give the female protagonist sexual agency. So the major shift that I notice is like rather than like taking virginity as like a condition of fear and as a condition to like be protected, which it's formulated as in the society that the women are in, like by the end of the story the women are sort of able to, they're in a condition where they don't feel fear and can escape that.
I think she allows the female protagonist, who's normally in fairy tales, normally serves kind of as like a tale of warning to young women to, you know, don't stray off the path in Red Riding Hood, you know, don't put yourself in danger and all the implications of that. And so she makes these young women, then they're not victims anymore. I think they are placed in dangerous situations, but then they use it to their advantage and they accept their sexuality and actually like end up imposing power on the monsters or the beasts. Like a good one is the Little Red Riding Hood rewrite, which has escaped my mind right now.
The Company of Wolves.
Yeah, in the Company of Wolves. And The Tiger's Bride, which is kind of like rewrite of The Beauty and the Beast as well.
Yeah. I think this is probably a good time to go on to our next question, which, in a broad sense, what sorts of gender identity-based barriers do you think that women, trans, and gender nonconforming writers face. Just to give you some stats, some of the listeners might have heard of a thing called the Vita Count, which is a website which is, I think, entirely volunteer run. And what they do is document the number of women. It started out just documenting the number of women who were published in major publications, and they've recently become a lot more intersectional in their approach. So they document based on gender identity, race and ethnicity, sexuality, and ability. And if you go to the website, you can see all of their stats, and it's pretty staggering. Most publications have around a quarter or a third writers published are women, and a lot of them have zero other gender identities, so zero trans writers, zero gender nonconforming writers, and very few women of color. I think it's important to note that this isn't because they don't exist. And here to talk to us about some of the great trans and gender nonconforming writers is Maddie. I want to give her a chance to talk before we run out of time.
Yeah. Since there are a lot of publishing companies that aren't really publishing things about by trans and non-binary people, they're actually creating those spaces for themselves. So there's a number of publishing companies that are specifically trans or non-binary, and some that are even specifically trans people of color. And the reason for this is that there are some popular novels. The first one that comes to mind is something like Middlesex, that is a cis male writing about an intersex person. And one of the authors that I'm going to talk about today kind of critiqued this in saying that these portrayals of gender identity struggles are often ham-fisted, and despite authors' apparently good intentions, they often rehash stale, demeaning tropes. This was Casey Plett, who is a Canadian trans woman and an author, and I think that she said it really well. I mean, no one can tell your story better than you can. And so I have some really amazing people who have written some really cool stuff. I'll start kind of chronologically. There was a person named Jan Morris who was writing back in the 60s and 70s. She started out as a travel writer primarily. She actually relayed the first Everest summit to the Queen. She's a Welsh writer. She wrote this story called Last Letters from Hav, which actually has an introduction by Ursula Le Guin, who's also an awesome sci-fi writer. So this is a kind of a mix between travel writing and sort of science fiction, because it's this narrative account of a six-month trip to this place called Hav, which is sort of vaguely in the Mediterranean. And it starts off as kind of a typical travel writing, but then these sort of things start to appear that become more interesting, like some interesting religious things that go on the island, as well as some internal conflict. So it's this really cool, shining sort of a light on the social, a bit of a social critique. Another author I'd like to talk about is Lovame Corazon, who wrote this memoir that's this kind of combination of poetry and prose. It's sort of from a journal perspective. They wrote it when they were 19 years old, which is just amazing. And it tales the story of abuse and assault and dealing with gender dysphoria and being a sex worker. And it centers a lot around personal successes and failures in navigating the world as a healer. They balance these moments of trauma with times where they found real positive love and people who were making spaces for themselves. And they offer a lot of really cool kind of suggestions on how to build your community in a more open and safe and creative, refreshing way. The next one I want to talk about is Julie Serrano, who wrote a book, has written a bunch of books actually, but the one that I want to reference is called Whipping Girl, a transsexual woman on sexism and scapegoating of femininity. So the title kind of suggests this, but it's all personal essays that kind of deconstruct these socially acceptable narratives for trans women and how these aren't necessarily the actual perspective of these people. It's all about kind of, she did a lot of kind of groundbreaking in transgender politics and philosophy, and her work is now being read in colleges as sort of trans feminism, and she coined the phrase trans misogyny. She's really an amazing person, on top of being a prolific writer, a poet, a musician. She also got her PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology from Columbia. So she's really a phenomenal person. And the last person I want to talk about is a Lebanese-Canadian woman named Trish Salah, who has written a number of scholarly works, but she has also written a book of poetry called Wanting in Arabic. And this book discusses the nuances of identity, as well as kind of longing to be associated with your culture, your cultural background, and also having kind of a dissociation from it, not knowing her father's native tongue and just kind of her separation from that.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're all out of time for today. We'll go into a song and then that will be it for the episode. Thank you so much for listening. As usual, we could discuss forever. But here is Bjork with Venus as a Boy. Thank you.